Okay, yeah, good morning. I believe we are in Reality and the Cosmic Illusion, page 460, am I right? And we finished the, yes?
Paragraph 7, we're starting. If there is not this dual consciousness.
Yes, that's what I have marked.
So we are going to start with page 460, the paragraph starting with "If there is not this dual consciousness."
Correct, correct.
Okay, I've started the recording as well. There was the go ahead.
Sure. And so at this point, this is a rather long consideration that Sri Aurobindo is undertaking regarding the illusionist thesis that Brahman is real, but it is immutable and transcendental, and in some way completely separate from the rest of the whatever we experience, the phenomenal cosmos. And the phenomenal cosmos in itself is an illusion, because this is what has been called the Mayavadin proposition, particularly espoused by Advaita Vedanta, though it has a number of flavors. And he, as you see, is exploring these flavors. He'll tell you that this is a certain argument of a certain branch of that, and the other is another argument of another branch. My personal reading into the intricacies of these different Advaitin sort of sub-branches is not that deep, but if there are experts, they could tell you, which exactly are the schools that he's talking about. Nevertheless, he is very clear about the various positions that can be taken by the school. So where we are right now, he's looking at this possibility that the Brahman is actually differentiating its own consciousness through Maya. In other words, the Maya is a real power of Brahman. It's a power of its consciousness, or it is its consciousness itself. It is self-consciousness of the Brahman that is operating in a certain fashion in differentiating its own reality. Now, we find that that kind of view, he will himself say, lends itself to a certain duality. Though in its own right, the idea of the Brahman, the idea of the of Maya being the power of self-differentiation of the Brahman is a truth. So we find that he posits that truth, and then he also posits the truth of the possibility of a separation within Brahman, something like an active and a passive Brahman. In other words, one part of Brahman remains completely unchangeable, immutable, eternal, and another part, as it were, supports an action of differentiation and change. So these are the two views that he looks at that last paragraph. And in the outset, he's pointing out that if this kind of duality is proposed, the so-called illusory nature of the cosmos has a certain reality in the consciousness of Brahman, but not in its being. And so that kind of man, there's no substantial, whatever substance Brahman is made for does not extend itself to the cosmos. So he's saying that that type of viewing of the matter, it is I mean, we can think of it as a kind of a projection of the human condition onto Brahman. And he will make this even more clear in the next paragraph, because he'll point out that in our case, there is a division between subject and object. There is some disturbance. I think maybe. We find that he points to this power of Brahman to perceive. It is the percipient, as he says, Maya. In other words, Maya is something that it can observe, it can perceive it from the outside, from its immune status, because a division has been created within it. It can also perceive it from inside through the individuals in which it is the truth, the spiritual essence. And that is the idea of the Atman. Though he doesn't mention it clearly here, this particular argument is one in which he is positing the view that there is a Brahman, the same Brahman, it is transcendental outside the cosmos, but the same Brahman is immanent within all the entities of the cosmos as the Atman. And so from both the transcendence as well as from the individual immanence, it is perceiving this cosmos. And as a percipient, its perception is real. But the cosmos is unreal. And so, as he's saying that the percept is unreal. And the perception is partly real and partly unreal. Because from its Brahman status, what it is perceiving, its soul essence is perceiving something which is unreal. And what is the nature is perceiving something that it takes to be real. See, so this is the, as he says, a perception that is a half-real creator of unreal percepts. So one can see that there are severe paradoxes within these views. But at the same time, Sri Aurobindo gives each one of them, consideration. And in doing so, in this particular case, at least, he makes it clear that this view, though it is something that arises from an interpretation of the Upanishads, is not supported by the Upanishads. See, because according to the Upanishads, everything is substantially the Brahman. And so we find that somewhere in the middle of that paragraph, he says, in this view, one cannot accept the assertion of the Upanishads that the world is made out of the Supreme Existence, is a becoming, an outcome, or product of the Eternal Being. Brahman is not the cause. Brahman is not the material cause of the universe. The word material over here means substantial, not material in the sense of matter, but spiritual matter. It isn't. Our nature, as opposed to ourself, is not made of its spiritual substance. It is constructed out of the unreal reality of Maya. So this view that follows logically from this kind of perception or idea is contrary to what the Upanishads are talking about. This point he makes, which is a very severe paradox, since these positions are claiming to be the authoritative interpretation of the Upanishads.
Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Okay. If there is not the dual consciousness, if Maya is the sole conscious power of Brahman, then one of two things must be true. Either the reality of Maya as a power is that it is a subjective action of Brahman consciousness emerging out of its silence and superconscient immobility and passing through experiences that are real because they are part of the consciousness of Brahman, but unreal because they are not part of its being, or else Maya is Brahman's power of cosmic imagination inherent in his eternal being, creating out of nothing names, forms, and happenings that are not in any way real. In that case, Maya would be real, but her works entirely fictitious, pure imaginations. But can we affirm imagination as the sole dynamic or creative power of the eternal? Imagination is a necessity for a partial being with an ignorant consciousness, for it has to supplement its ignorance by imaginations and conjectures. There can be no place for such a movement in the soul consciousness of a soul reality, which has no reason to construct unrealities, for it is ever pure and self-complete. It is difficult to see what in its own being could impel or induce such a soul existence complete in its very essence, blissful in its eternity, containing nothing to be manifested, timelessly perfect to create an unreal time and space, and people it to all eternity with an interminable cosmic show of false images and happenings. This solution is logically untenable.
So here he is reinstating the first of the two possibilities he raised earlier, that indeed Maya is the conscious power of Brahman. So because remember earlier paragraph, he took up the notion of Maya as the self-differentiating power of Brahman. And then the other one being that of it being a creation of difference, a result, not the essence of Maya force, some power of Brahman's consciousness that resulted in the duality that he posited earlier. Interestingly, here, in some way or the other, it again comes down to a duality. Though he starts with a non-duality, he ends with a duality. And this cannot but be the case, because if we are positing that the cosmos is an illusion, but something else is real, we can immediately see that there must be a duality. I mean, there is an illusory cosmos and there is a real absolute. So to wish it away and bring it into a monistic line of thinking, as Advaita Vedanta does, is a sleight of hand. And it becomes very evident that that is so as you look at the various sides by which such an argument can be constructed. So over here he is reviving that notion that there is no dual consciousness. Maya is the sole conscious power of Brahman. But if it is the sole conscious of power of the Brahman, and yet if it is to create an illusory cosmos, then again we have something which Brahman is not conscious of. And so he is accounting for it over here by saying that there are two ways that this can be done. One is that it is acting on its own like the imagination. The first possibility he takes up is not the imagination, but something which is more like either a dream or a daydream. In other words, the being of Brahman is not involved in it. The consciousness of Brahman has spawned a subsidiary effect. See, it is sort of like a kind of a thread of the Brahman, of Maya's action, of the consciousness of Brahman, which has its own reality, and a kind of an automatism which is going on by itself, free of the conscious will of its own consciousness. In other words, Brahman has a consciousness. That consciousness, the will of that consciousness, is not interfering in this automatism. So we may think of this from the subjective human point of view to be something like a dream or daydream. In a dream, what we consider to be conscious has gone under the threshold, and some kind of automatism is at work. So too in daydream. In daydream, we find that we are conscious of it in a kind of a dim way, but the mind is moving according to certain associative patterns that are unconscious. The other option that he takes up is that of imagination. In other words, it is a conscious activity, but it is an activity that is plucking out of the possibilities within the subjective, whatever it can create. So it doesn't have any objective reality. So these two possibilities would allow Brahman to be free in being and in essence of consciousness from the cosmos. But then he discounts the imagination idea over here by saying that this is a projection of our human limitations, because imagination as a human faculty is something that is actually trying to fill in the blanks of its ignorance. We imagine so that we can move ahead and fill in what we can't see. But this cannot be the case for Brahman, which already is in possession of all its ideas and possibilities. So the imagination argument is not a good one. It seems to be a imposition of a anthropomorphic kind upon the infinity of self-consciousness that Brahman is supposed to have.
Daniel Harris, would you like to read next?
Sure. The other solution, the idea of a purely subjective, unreal reality, starts from the distinction made by the mind in physical nature between its subjective and objective experiences. For it is the objective alone of which it is sure, as entirety and solidity real, or probably solidly real. But such a distinction could hardly exist in Brahman consciousness, since here there is either no subject and no object, or Brahman itself is the sole possible subject of its consciousness. and the sole possible object. There could be nothing externally objective in Brahman. Since there is nothing else than Brahman, this idea then of a subjective action of consciousness creating a world of fictions other than or distorting the whole, distorting the sole true object looks like an imposition on the Brahman by our mind. It imposes on the pure and perfect reality a feature of its own imperfection, not truly attributable to the perception of a supreme being. On the other hand, the distinction between the consciousness and the being of Brahman could not be valid. Unless Brahman being and Brahman consciousness are two distinct entities. The consciousness imposing its experiences on the pure existence of the being, but unable to touch or affect or penetrate it. Brahman then, whether as the supreme soul self-existence or the self of the real unreal individual in Maya, would be aware by its true consciousness of the illusions imposed on him, and would know them as illusions only some energy of Maya nature, or something in it, would be deluded by its own inventions, or else, not being really deluded, still persist in behaving and feeling as if it were deluded. This duality is what happens to our consciousness in the ignorant, separates itself from the works of nature and is aware within of the shell of the self as the sole truth, and the rest is not self and not real, but has on the surface to act as if the rest too were real. But this solution negates the soul and it and indivisible pure existence and pure awareness of the Brahman. It creates a dualism within its featureless unity, which is not other in its purport than the dualism of the double. Principle in the Sankhya view of things, Purusha and Prakriti, soul and nature. These solutions then must be put aside as untenable unless we modify our first view of the reality and concede to it a power of manifold status of consciousness or a power of manifold status of existence.
Yeah, so similar argument is proposed by him for the subjective reality of Brahman. Subjective reality of Maya, or the subjective activity of Maya. What he's saying over here is that, this is the argument of something which is sort of like a daydream, as I said. In other words, Brahman has a consciousness, but that consciousness can operate on its own without the consent or the knowledge of Brahman, but without its consent. In other words, its will is not involved. It subjects Brahman to its own action, as it were. So he's saying that this is a human imposition upon Brahman, since we have that kind of division between subject and object, and the action, activity of the consciousness can operate in such a manner, separated from the world of objects. But to Brahman, which is the only thing there is, there are no objects outside of it. Whatever it considers and whatever it builds from must be itself. So this notion of actually operating in some way outside of an objective world a reality is not something which is true to the definition of Brahman. Then he points out that this kind of a view is, however, that which is posited by the school of Sankhya with regard to phenomenal perception in the individual. In other words, we see the world as one in which we can separate our consciousness and observe it, as a pure witness, while at the same time the world just imposes itself upon our observation as something which is completely, outside of it. It doesn't, it can't affect it, but at the same time it can't be affected by it. So we end up with a dualism. Again, this is another dualism. In this dualism, you have Brahman, which is completely untouched by things, but observing it, like the Purusha witness, and consciousness presenting all these realities of the cosmos to it, subjecting it to those realities. And it is an observer, but not really subject to it. So this is the dualist view of spirit or soul and nature as two separate, realities. And so he's saying these can be other ways of talking about this, but they completely abrogate the definition of Brahman as the one thing there is. It's not a monism. And so that's why he ends by saying, this solution must then be put aside as untenable unless we modify our first view of the reality and concede to it a power of manifold status of consciousness. That is, not only one status, but a variety of forms of consciousness which are independent from it, or a power of manifold status of existence. In other words, you have the absolute, and then you have a number of other states of being, of Brahman, or to which the absolute does not have any control, as it were.
When would you like to read next?
Sure. But again, dual consciousness, if we admit it.
You can't be heard, Owen. Perhaps your mic is very low or something. Can you speak up or do something to increase the volume?
Can you hear me now? How about now? Hello? Hello?
Owen, if you go to tools, at the top of the screen, and then options, then under that you see audio settings. There is a volume setting for microphone. Hope that helps.
Yeah, it's I guess you can't hear me.
We can hear you, but it's very soft.
Okay.
Maybe we can...
Because I'm looking at the settings, and it's, it says it's on high. It's all the way on high, so that's funny.
Did you unclick the automatically adjust?
Yes. So I don't quite know what's going on.
Perhaps we can give it a few more seconds, and if we can't figure it out, we can have somebody else read.
Could it be your settings on your computer outside of Skype?
My volume is all the way up.
Owen, if that's okay, we can figure that out later and have somebody else read right now.
Sure. Yes.
Bye. Yeah, sorry. Karen Mitchell, would you like to read next?
Yes. I'm going to close the door because there may be some background noise.
But again, the dual consciousness, if we admit it, cannot be explained as a dual power of knowledge-ignorance, valid for the supreme existence as it is for us in the universe. For we cannot suppose that Brahman is at all subject to Maya, since that would mean a principle of ignorance clouding the eternal self-awareness. It would be to impose the limitations of our own consciousness on the eternal reality. An ignorance which occurs or intervenes in the course of manifestation as a result of a subordinate action of consciousness and as part of a divine cosmic plan and its evolutionary meaning is one thing and is logically conceivable. A meaningless ignorance or illusion eternal in the original consciousness of the reality is another thing, and not easily conceivable. It appears as a violent mental construction which has no likelihood of validity in the truth of the Absolute. The dual consciousness of Brahman must be in no way an ignorance, but a self-awareness coexistent with a voluntary will to erect a universe of illusions which are held in a frontal perception aware once of self and the illusory world, so that there is no delusion, no feeling of its reality. The delusion takes place only in the illusory world itself, and the self or Brahman in the world either enjoys with a free participation or witnesses itself separate and intangible the play which lays its magical spell only upon the nature mind created for her action by Maya. But this would seem to signify that the eternal, not content with its pure absolute existence, has the need to create, to occupy itself throughout time with a drama of names and forms and happenings. It needs, being soul, to see itself as many, being peace and bliss and self-knowledge, to observe an experience or representation of mingled knowledge and ignorance, delight and suffering, unreal existence and escape from unreal existence. For the escape is for the individual being constructed by Maya. The eternal does not need to escape, and the play continues its cycle forever. Or if not the need, there is the will to so create, or there is the urge or the automatic action of these contraries. But if we consider the sole eternity of pure existence attributed to the reality, all alike, need, will, urge, or automatism, are equally impossible and incomprehensible. This is an explanation of a sort, but it is an explanation which leaves the mystery still beyond logic or comprehension. For this dynamic consciousness of the eternal is a direct contradiction of its static and real nature. A will or power to create or manifest is undoubtedly there, but if it is a will or power of the Brahman, it can only be for a creation of realities of the real or a manifestation of the timeless process of its being in time eternity. For it seems incredible that the sole power of the reality should be to manifest something contrary to itself or to create non-existent things in an illusory universe.
So, as we saw earlier, Sri Aurobindo's method is to point to each of these positions as something which has contradictions in them, and at the same time try to offer a solution which often parts the veil and shows us glimpses of his view of things before coming back to the argument that he has taken up. So to here we find that with this notion of Brahman being subject to Maya, he raises the problem of the impotence of Brahman, we may say, in that case. In other words, how come it has no power, or does it determine these realities? Is it actually using its will to project realities which aren't realities, things which don't have a basis in itself, which contradict its own, truth? So here he provides a solution in passing, and then he again brings back the original argument, and we can see how he provides the solution first. As he says, an ignorance which occurs or intervenes in the course of manifestation as a result of a subordinate action of consciousness and as a part of a divine cosmic plan and its evolutionary meaning is one thing and is logically conceivable. So here he brings up his view. In other words, there can be a subsidiary action, there can be a division within Maya or within Brahman, but this division is not something that is outside of the will of Brahman, that it is imposed upon Brahman. It is a self-becoming of Brahman, and it is a self-becoming with a purpose and with meaning. And hence, it is another dimension of Brahman itself. So that is, as he says, logically conceivable. But a meaningless ignorance or illusion, eternal in the original consciousness of the reality, is another thing and not easily conceivable. So that is the contradiction that he points out by bringing out his own view of things. the dual consciousness of Brahman must be in no way an ignorance. That's the main point, that even if it is a dual consciousness, it is a self-determined duality or dual consciousness. But a self-awareness coexistent with a voluntary will to erect a universe of illusions which are held in a frontal perception, aware at once of self and the illusory world, so that there is no delusion, yet no feeling of its reality. See? So this is the way in which it is done, but then he brings up the question of meaning. This is, he has already introduced this, that it must be due to some kind of a self-choice of Brahman to manifest itself in a certain way, and it must be meaningful. But then, what could be its meaning? And the rest of the paragraph really questions the view that it is a voluntary projection of itself, and yet it has no meaning. So there the problem that arises comes from asking the question, why would it want to do this? What is its need? Since it is immutable, what is its need to create things, I mean, go out of its way, as it were, to create a world of contradiction, of things which don't, represent its own truths. A satisfactory answer to that question would be what he has already proposed, the notion of an evolutionary meaning. In other words, that the meaning of this is the self-denial or self-contradiction of the consciousness of Brahman as a starting point for the manifestation of its truths. In other words, it becomes the exercise of divine consciousness as a way of measuring its own manifestation, measuring its own possibilities that occur over time through evolution. That would give a certain sense to it, a meaning to it. But if we take that out, then we are left with this problem, that if indeed it is a choice of the Brahman to create this situation of illusion, in other words, it creates a possibility of experiencing things other than its own nature for beings that are within that subsidiary action of consciousness. And if it does this consciously, then why is it doing it? What in it is served through this will, action of this will?
Debashish, I'm not very familiar with Indian spirituality. Is this evolutionary focus, was it seen prior to Sri Aurobindo, or is he unique in that way?
Yeah, he is unique in that way. He's definitely unique in that way. There is a kind of evolutionary idea in Sankhya, but Sankhya proceeds from a duality. So what he touched on in the previous paragraph, and that evolutionary idea works like this. It says that there are two different realities, and therefore they're substantially different. In other words, the essence of the substance is different. One is soul and the other is nature. And you may say nature in its origin is matter, material. And soul is consciousness. And the two are together. And being together, though they are of completely different quality, the material entity, due to its contact with consciousness, begins evolving to make itself more conscious, in other words. So then what happens is that it develops more, conscious features. So we arrive at an evolution. So things start, a Prakriti starts adapting itself to become an instrument of Purusha. But they don't really consider it an instrument. They feel that it will always remain separate. It is motivated to change due to contact with Purusha, but will not be able to become an instrument of Purusha. It will at the most remain a kind of a percept, as he says it, of Purusha. So evolution in that sense does not have any will in it. It is a kind of automatism that arises due to the contact of two dissimilars. Now, this notion of evolution that he is talking about here, which is that there is evolution, as one might say, as a dimension of self-manifestation of the real, of Brahman, is not an idea that was in Indian philosophy before Sri Aurobindo. So some people have said that it's what might be called a post-Darwinian notion. In other words, Sri Aurobindo arises in history after Darwin, has read Darwin, and therefore is positing a kind of an evolutionary idea in terms of consciousness. Of course, Darwin would not have, sort of accepted as genuine an idea of evolution in consciousness. But other philosophers like Bergson, Henry Spencer, etc., have already appeared that do consider the idea of evolution of consciousness of some kind. And so Sri Aurobindo is not alone or completely alone in this in an international sense, but certainly from the viewpoint of positing this as a possibility within philosophy, giving a certain coherence to the notion of Brahman and its relations with the world is something which he is the first in doing.
Thank you.
Devishish, I've heard it said that the idea of the seven avatars or with their different characterizations is seems to imply a sort of evolution. What would you say about that?
Yeah, the point has been made, but that's a modern point. In other words, there is no discourse about this any time before. You may say in a symbolic form, there may have been some understanding of this. And definitely one could say that Sri Aurobindo himself is pointing to hints about this in the Veda, going all the way back to the Veda, and maybe even in the Upanishads. There are hints about this. But in the later period of what is called Indian philosophy, this idea of progress in time seems to have completely lost itself. What arises, even apart from the illusionistic schools that he's considering, there are other schools that are not illusionistic, like Vaishnavism or Tantra. They are not. They believe that the world is real, but even they believe that the condition in which we find ourselves is permanent, not temporary. That what we may call the condition of ignorance is a permanent manifestation of the divine. So how do they answer this question, you may ask, of meaning? They don't, again, we come back to what we were discussing earlier. They don't make meaning into a, desideratum, you may say, of explanation. So for the Vaishnavs, we find that ignorance exists as a certain kind of play of the divine. The divine can have many types of the play of its delight. One such form of the play of its delight would be this form of becoming ignorant of itself and subjecting itself to this type of experience. That would be a kind of delight, you may say, delight of the masked play. We can look upon a play in a theater which has all kinds of atrocities in it, but we know that we are sort of quote unquote enjoying it from the viewpoint of a possibility, but we are not ourselves trapped by it. We know that it is a masked play, as he says over here. He says it. How does he put it? That it isn't touched by these things. It has its own reality, but that Brahman is not touched by it. So we can have that, or we can have, as in Tantra, it becomes a field of possibility. That's a lot more along the lines of what he's saying. But they are not positing a teleology. In other words, they are not saying that this is the reason for its existence. The ignorance is going to ultimately become a manifestation of the divinity, but they will say that it is a latency of the divine, and those who develop all the powers make it something at an individual level that is close to the divine. So, I mean, we can push it just one step further and say, if it can happen in the individual level, why not in the collective or in the cosmic level? And then bring in an evolution. But if you don't do that, then it remains a question mark, as he points out.
So do you think that Sri Aurobindo, his thought was influenced by the eruption of evolutionary thought in the West?
He's living in a certain world. He's living in a, what Heidegger calls being in the world. In other words, it's not necessarily even an influence. It's the context of your thoughts. You live in a world in which the fabric of your thinking is made up of whatever else has been thought and is being thought around you. And so I think evolution seems to be an idea whose time had come, and it makes its appearance, whether in a materialist form in Darwin or in a spiritual form or idealist form in people like Bergson, etc. For Sri Aurobindo, he certainly had an awareness of all these things. They might have been triggers. There's an interesting part in the record of yoga where he's talking about another German thinker who also had some ideas about evolution. and he's reading his work. I think it is Haeckel or one of these German philosophers. And he's reading his work, and as he reads it, he's recording the fact that it actually opens up for him vision and experience of certain realities, spiritual realities. So this is also happening. So when we use the term influence, you know, it has a number of ways of operating, and it's certainly very possible that the existence of the idea of evolution in his mindset triggered this understanding in a deeper spiritual nature.
Okay, thank you for that.
Devashish, many times you've kind of talked about this singularity of Sri Aurobindo with his evolutionary perspective, but this time it seems like the bringing in the mindset of the time, or that evolution's the concept was surfacing in the certain philosophers, that seems to be an additional piece, you know, that Sri Aurobindo uses it all, you know, uses the history of Indian philosophy, uses the context of the time, that it's a little more complicated than just the history of Indian philosophy that he comes to these concepts. Does that kind of make sense?
Completely, completely. I absolutely agree. Yeah, I mean, it certainly is the fact that he's writing to some extent even directly addressing the Indian philosophical tradition. But from the very beginning, you know, his own makeup and even the circumstances under which this text is being written are international. Here is, this text is actually being it's being written and immediately being translated into French and being published in both English and French in Pondicherry itself as well as in Paris. So you can see that, you know, and his own consciousness at this point is clearly a hybrid consciousness, which is first, you know, I mean, first undertakes its education in England and then has come to the Indian tradition. And his experiences are being filtered through his own mental nature. In that sense, you know, that which is constituted by these international ideas.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Owen. I can't hear you at all. Maybe you can write in the chat, sort of thing or something, because I can't hear anything that you're saying. I can hear you a little bit. Sorry, can anybody else tell me what Owen is saying, because I can't hear him at all.
I guess he's dying in, right?
Okay.
Just give me a second.
Okay. Hegel used the dialectic and Marx appropriated this. Yeah? Both posited a form of evolution. Yes, they did. And you can say that kind of idea of the evolution of consciousness of a certain kind has been around. You know, that's also, of course, Hegel is, in terms of the extended notion of modernity, Hegel is a modern thinker. He's earlier than Darwin, but he's certainly a philosopher who has thought some thought of a kind of evolution, you may say. Yes, that is true. You see, but one thing is that, those ideas were already, floating around, and certainly Sri Aurobindo would have been familiar with Hegel's thought. He was, he's the way in which he is approaching it is a little more complex. That because of two things. One is that the Indian tradition is talking about the transcendental reality as being truly real. And so the whole issue of, evolution of something that is involved in matter and evolving intelligence or consciousness out of it is something that has to be explained in terms of something else which is immutable, transcendent, and which has timeless, spaceless consciousness. So that is one thing. And then the other thing that he has to explain is the individual action. Each individual. So in Hegel's case, a zeitgeist is at work, which in a sense is the evolution of the cosmos. And it is utilizing people, places, etc., to carry out its experiments and emerge into synthesis of a variety of kinds. But in Sri Aurobindo's case, individual agency is much greater because the entirety of the transcendent exists within each individual. And he has to explain it in terms of these two positions of the transcendent, the transcendental and the immanent, and what is the cosmos, to both of these? What kind of evolution is taking place which relates to both the transcendent and the cos and the individual? How does it justify itself to these two stations of the Brahman, one may say? That becomes the issue. Yeah, the ideal of human unity dealt with evolution throughout history. That is a little questionable. Is it dealing with evolution? It is dealing with a certain trend, certainly. But whether it's dealing with evolution is a question mark. Has humanity evolved? I don't think it has. We have, kind of changed evolution of ideas, maybe, yes. Evolution of ideas is still part of nature. Evolution of consciousness is something which is creating mutations in nature. Yes. Yes, Owen, you're right. You could also read the fact that there is, in the human cycle, he's certainly positing different structures of consciousness and in history. And he is pointing to the fact that we are entering into what he calls a subjective age. And that that will eventually lead us into a spiritual age, you know. So there is a certain kind of evolutionism involved in that work. True.
I'm not seeing that at all.
Can you be a little louder, Joanna? I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I can't see Devashish's, Owen's typing.
Oh.
I don't know what he's saying.
Oh, you have to. Do you have your? You have a symbol on the top right with a little blurb-like thing there. You have to click on that, then you can see the chat.
On the call window on the top right, there'll be like that. You know, the blurb icon.
It's a speech bubble.
Got it. Thank you.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Sure. There is so far no satisfying answer to the riddle. But it may be that we err in attributing any kind of reality, however illusory at bottom, to Maya or her works. The true solution lies in facing courageously the mystery of its and their utter unreality. This absolute unreality seems to be envisaged by certain formulations of illusionism or by certain arguments put forward in its favor. This side, then, of the problem has to pass under consideration before we can examine with confidence the solutions that rest on a relative or partial reality of the universe. There is indeed a line of reasoning which gets rid of the problem by excluding it. It affirms that the question how the illusion generated, how the universe manages to be there in the pure existence of Brahman, is illegitimate. The problem does not exist because the universe is non-existent. Maya is unreal. Brahman is the sole truth, alone and self-existent forever. Brahman is not affected by any illusory consciousness, so Brahman is not affected by any illusory consciousness. No universe has come into existence within its timeless reality. But this evasion of the difficulty is either a sophism, which means nothing, an acrobacy of verbal logic, the logical reason hiding its head in the play of words and ideas, and refusing to see or to solve a real and baffling difficulty. Or else it means too much, since in effect it gets rid of all relations of Maya to Brahman by affirming her as an independent, absolute, non-reality along with the universe created by her. If a real universe does not exist, the cosmic illusion exists, and we are bound to inquire how it came into being or how it manages to exist. What is its relation or non-relation to the reality? What is meant by our own existence in Maya, by our subjugation to her cycles, by our liberation from her? For in this view, we have to suppose that Brahman is not the percipient of Maya or her works. Maya herself is not a power of Brahman consciousness. Brahman is superconscient, immersed in its own pure being, or is conscious only of its own absoluteness. It has nothing to do with Maya. But in that case, either Maya cannot exist even as an illusion, or there would be a dual entity or two entities, a real, eternal, superconscious, or conscious only of itself, and an illusory power that creates and is conscious of a false universe. We are back on the horns of the dilemma, and with no prospect of getting free from our impalement on it, unless we escape by concluding that since all philosophy is part of Maya, all philosophy is also an illusion. Problems abound, but no conclusion is possible. For what we are confronted with is a pure, static, and immutable reality and an illusory dynamism, the two absolutely contradictory of each other, with no greater truth beyond them in which their secret can be found and their contradictions discover a reconciling issue.
So he's moving away from that view that Brahman is the percipient in this paragraph, and he's also considering some positions that have been taken up by these Advaitin schools, where they don't want to consider the question at all because they consider it to be illegitimate, as he says. The illegitimacy here, earlier we saw another case of illegitimacy where they claim that you cannot ask this question because Maya is inscrutable, that it is a power of Brahman, but it is inscrutable. It belongs to a zone of Brahman to which Brahman itself is not privy. That was an argument that Sri Aurobindo thought in a similar way to be spurious. Now, similarly, he is saying that this kind of an argument is a spurious argument. It doesn't warrant serious consideration because it seems to be a solipsism, as he says over there. It is a argument as of the sophists. The sophists are a school of professional philosophers in Greece during the time of Socrates. And Plato talks a good deal about these sophists and the dialogic method which Socrates debated them with. And usually would keep bringing the argument to an existential frame, frame of a phenomenal and existential frame, and showing them that their trickeries of the mind, you know, their, as he says over here, their acrobatics, you know, don't actually refer to reality. They don't belong to reality. And so, in a similar way over here, he is pointing to the fact that this kind of an argument really is just a kind of a jugglery with words. Or we are talking about a duality, again, a radical duality, in which we have Brahman, who is immutable and completely lost in itself, and something else, a Maya, which has no real existence, you know, a contradiction in terms. And he says that that kind of an approach, the very purpose of thinking about this is completely undercut. All philosophy itself is shown to be an illusion, and no conclusion is possible. The best one can do is undertake this type of jugglery and forget about the notion of trying to make sense of the cosmos.
Devashish, would you comment on the fact that even though we are going through these paragraphs and they're very difficult philosophical arguments, but in our time, Buddhism, certainly in the West, is such a dominant philosophy, in a way, it's kind of counterintuitive that such a difficult illusionary philosophy is really what is dominant in terms of spiritual philosophy in the West.
Yeah, you're right, Margaret. I think the thing is that people don't ask these questions. So this question that he is starting from, which is if the cosmic experience is something illusory, what is its relationship with the ground, which is true? This question is not asked. We posit, and which is what the Buddha did. You see, the Buddhist philosophy arose in a post-Upanishadic period. When they felt the need, and Buddhism was not the only philosophy, others arose like it, they felt the need to make this these ideas of the Upanishads more accessible to people. And so they felt that they ought to go out and make people focus on their everyday existence and see the need for getting out of it. And so that's why the Buddha said at a certain place that, you know, of course, these are Mahayana texts, and but there is a text in which he says, my experience of enlightenment was, you know, as multifarious. I knew as many truths as there are leaves to the Bodhi tree. But when I came out to teach my method, to people, I used, as it were, only two leaves of that, you know, sort of, you know, that manifestation of infinite truths. I used only two truths. and these were the truths of suffering and desire. And because these are universal in the phenomenal world, and by pointing to these, I could push people towards the experience of truth. So it's really an empirical philosophy, and it does not ask these questions about what is the relationship between this and some truth, but just tells you that there is a way out of this particular experience.
So would you say it's a more expediency philosophy and doesn't go into the...
it doesn't go into metaphysics, but but is more experiencing. And then moreover, what has happened in our times is that Buddhism has made itself more world-affirming. It has emphasized things like compassion, mindfulness, which is really a way of being in the world rather than of escape from it, without really addressing the issue of the purpose of the world. There is no question of addressing the notion of purpose, but rather of living a life in which one is free of this illusory, entrapment. So it has become a more world, affirming from that point of view, but not teleological. And it doesn't address the question of ultimate realities and their relations, but it does address the question of empirical realities and their solution.
It's like a manual, a manual for the instrument.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Debshi.
Matteo, would you like to read next?
Yes, sorry. If Brahman,
if Brahman.
If Brahman, thank you. If Brahman is not the percipient, then the percipient must be the individual being. But this percipient is created by the illusion and unreal. The percept, the world, is an illusion created by an illusion and unreal. The perceiving consciousness is itself an illusion and therefore unreal. But this deprives everything of significance. Our spiritual existence and our salvation from Maya, no less than our temporal existence and our immersion in Maya, all are of an equal unreality and unimportance. It is possible to take a less rigid standpoint and hold that Brahman as Brahman has nothing to do with Maya. It is eternally free from all illusion or any commerce with illusion. But Brahman, as the individual percipient or as the self of all being here, has entered into Maya and can, in the individual withdraw from it. And this withdrawal is for the individual an act of supreme importance. But here, a dual being is imposed on Brahman, and a reality attributed to something that belongs to the cosmic illusion, to the individual being of Brahman in Maya. For Brahman, as the self of all, is not even phenomenally bound and does not need to escape from her. Moreover, salvation cannot be of importance if bondage is unreal, and bondage cannot be real unless Maya and her world are real. The absolute unreality of Maya disappears and gives place to a very comprehensive, even if perhaps only a practical and temporal reality. To avoid this conclusion, it must be said that our individuality is unreal. It is Brahman who withdraws from a reflection of itself in the figment of individuality, and its extinction is our release, our salvation. But Brahman, always free, cannot suffer by bondage or profit by salvation, and a reflection, a figment of individuality, is not a thing that can need salvation. A reflection, a figment, a mere image in the deceptive mirror of Maya cannot suffer a real bondage or profit by a real salvation. If it be said that it is a conscious reflection or figment, and therefore can really suffer and enter into the bliss of release, the question arises, whose is the consciousness that so suffers in this fictitious existence? For there can be no real consciousness except that of the one existence. So that once more there is established a dual consciousness for Brahman, a consciousness or superconscious free from the illusion, and a consciousness subject to the illusion. And we begin, and we have again substantiated a certain reality of our existence and experience in Maya. For if our being is that of the Brahman, our consciousness, something of the consciousness of the Brahman, with whatever qualification, it is to that extent real. And if our being, why not the being of the universe?
So again, he continues the idea of the previous paragraph, probing its, sense in terms of percipient, percept, and perception. And here he is talking about who then is the percipient if Brahman is not the percipient, which is the conclusion of that previous paragraph, which he holds to be meaningless. But this is the same meaninglessness which is further analyzed in this paragraph through the viewpoint of the individual. So if the percept was unreal, what about the individual who also is a percipient, just as there was an absolute percipient that has been denied in the case of Brahman? is there then, who is the percipient then? Is it the individual? So the individual is the secondary percipient. And since the percept is illusory and the individual has only reality within the percept, that perception must also be illusory. This is the argument, and this is the contradiction over here. And then he takes the slightly less rigorous view, you may say, or radical view, going back to an earlier argument he had made, which is that of the immanence of Brahman. In other words, there is something real in us. Brahman is real in us, but the rest of us is a construction of an illusion. So then the question arises that there is a Brahman, but there is a complete duality between that and whatever we call cosmos. And if the Brahman is real inside us, then the question that he raises is that why are we thinking of this unreal or illusory Maya, which is creating a illusory world, which is dualism, has no basis in Brahman, when Brahman is the percipient from two ends, why is not this cosmos itself also a formation of Brahman?
I have a question about these words. If non-being is accepted as part of reality, why not unreal itself? Meaning, everything is included, if we assume, then even unreal is also, can be, all contradictions are included since it is the one. So even the unreal also can be part of this. Will that make sense?
It could, the absolute nature of Brahman, if we say that all contradictions should be contained within it, that applies up to the level of the disappearance of the existent, because you could say that there is a sort of indescribable status of Brahman, where whatever we call existence and non-existence can be transcended. But within the domain of existence, even if we talk of a transcendent existence, this law of non-contradiction must be the ultimate one, the summit one, one may say. That being and non-being cannot be contained within the same, if it exists, if we can say of it exists. In other words, what in the Vedantic idea is called Satchidananda, a pure being or pure existence, up to that layer, which is itself a transcendence. And as that's what he's talking about here with regard to Brahman as a transcendence, that being and non-being are contradictions up to that point. Non-being cannot be the same thing as being.
Basically, whenever we use a word, it automatically has, because of our language, automatically has its opposite. And the one is supposed to include everything that we can refer to and its opposite as well. So from that point of view, I'm saying.
No, you're right, that, but that is true, but that is... each one of these, the one also exists in different statuses, as he talked about this manifold one, right? So the status of the one at any particular level of that manifold existence has contradictions that it cannot resolve. Beyond it, it can. So if we say beyond the realm of existence, there is a status of the one in which existence and non-existence both coexist, we can posit that. But that is not something that can, you know, encompass even Satchidananda, one may say. That is even beyond Satchidananda, that one.
Shall we stop here and continue next time?
Okay, sure.
So let's continue in a couple of weeks. Thank you, everyone.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for